Welcome to Love's Tender Flame. Tales of Romance. I'm Ardell. Reading Come Out of the Kitchen by Alice Duer Miller. Chapter 5. Jane Ellen was standing in the office, with her hands folded, and an expression of the utmost calm upon her face. Crane came in quickly and would have shut the door, but for the fact that Smithfield was immediately behind him.
"Beg pardon, sir," he said firmly, sliding into the room, "but I must look to the fire."
Crane frowned.
"The fire's all right," he said shortly.
But Smithfield was not to be put off his duties, and began to poke the logs and sweep the hearth until peremptorily ordered to go. When the door finally closed behind him, Crane stood silent a moment with his hand on the mantelpiece. The whole tone of the interview, upon which it now occurred to him he had rushed somewhat too hastily, would be decided by whether he spoke standing up or sitting down. His feelings were for the first, his intellect for the latter position. His intellect won. He sat down in a deep chair and crossed his legs. As he did so, the cook's eyes, which had hitherto been fixed on the carpet, now raised themselves to the level of his neat pumps and black silk socks. He was aware of this, but did not allow himself to be disconcerted. "I suppose you can guess why I sent for you, Jane Ellen," he said.
"The dinner was not satisfactory, sir."
"I doubt if you could cook an unsatisfactory dinner if you tried," he returned. "No, the trouble is over something that happened an hour or so before dinner."
"You did not approve, perhaps, of that gentleman, Mr. Tucker, coming into the kitchen, but indeed I could not help that."
"Oh," said Crane. "So, Tucker was in the kitchen, was he?"
"Yes, sir, until Brindlebury told him the motor was coming with the ladies."
"No," said Crane, "the difficulty is over a former visitor of yours. I think it my right, even my duty, to prevent anything happening in this house of which I disapprove, and I do not approve, Jane Ellen, of strangers coming into my house and kissing the cook."
He looked at her squarely as he said this, but her eyes remained fixed on his feet, as she replied docilely,
"Yes, sir, perhaps it would be better for you to speak to the young man about it."
"Ah," returned her employer, as one now going over familiar ground, "you mean to imply that it was not your fault?"
She did not directly answer this question. She said,
"I suppose in your class of life, a gentleman would not, under any circumstances, kiss a young lady against her will."
"Well," answered Crane with some amusement, "he certainly never ought to do so. And, by the way, one of the points about this incident seems to be that the young man in question had the appearance of being a gentleman."
"He certainly considers himself so."
There was a pause, then Crane said seriously, "I don't want to interfere in your concerns further than I have to, or to offer you advice."
"But I should be so glad to have you offer me advice, sir. It is one of the few things a gentleman may offer a girl in my position, and she accept with a clear conscience."
For the first time, Crane looked at her with suspicion. Her tone and look were demure in the extreme. He decided to go on.
"Well, then," he said, "if I were you, I would not have a gentleman, especially such an impulsive one, hanging about unless you were engaged to him with the consent of your family."
She raised her chin without lifting her eyes.
"It's not the consent of our families that's lacking," she remarked.
"Oh, he's asked you to marry him?"
"Almost every day, sir, until today."
"And today he didn't?"
"Today he said he wouldn't marry me if I were the last woman in the world."
"And what did you think about that?"
"I thought it wasn't true, sir."
Crane laughed aloud at this direct answer. "And it sounds to me if you were right, Jane Ellen," he said, "but at the same time I can't see for the life of me why, if you don't mean to marry him, you let him kiss you."
"If you please, sir, it's not always possible to prevent. You see, I'm not very large."
Crane looked at her and had to admit that the feat would be extremely easy. She hardly came up to one shoulder. Almost any man. Hastily putting aside this train of thought, he said in a more judicial tone, "You know your own affairs best. Is the young man able to support you?"
"Yes, sir, very comfortably."
"And yet you don't consider marrying him?"
"No, sir. I don't love him."
Matters had suddenly become rather serious. "You would rather work for your living than marry a man you don't love?" Crane asked almost in spite of himself.
For the first time, the cook looked up straight at him as she answered, "I think I would rather die, sir."
This time it was Crane's eyes that dropped. Fortunately, he reflected, she could not have any idea how sharply her remark had touched his own inner state. How clearly she saw that it was wrong to do just what he was contemplating doing, to marry for prudence rather than for love. He found himself speculating on the genesis of the moral sense, how it developed in difficulties rather than in ease. That was why he could learn something on the subject from his cook. Here was a girl working for her living, working hard and long, for wages, which, though he had once, as he remembered, told Reed seemed excessive, now appeared to him the merest pittance. Certainly it seemed as if all the hardships of such a life would be smoothed away by this suggested marriage, and yet she could assert clearly that she would rather die than make it, whereas he, with nothing very much at stake, had actually been contemplating for several months the making of just such a marriage. He was interrupted by her respectful tones.
"Will that be all, sir?"
"Yes," he answered in a voice that lacked finality. "I suppose that's all, except if that fellow comes bothering you any more, let me know, and I'll tell him what I think of him." Jane Ellen lifted the corner of her mouth in a terrible smile.
"Oh," she said, "I don't think he'll come bothering any more."
"You're very optimistic, Jane Ellen."
"Oh, I beg your pardon, sir, those long words."
Very hopeful, I meant. He'll be back tomorrow."
"Not after what I said to him."
"Well, Jane Ellen, if you have really found the potent thing to say under such circumstances, you're a true benefactor to your sex." She looked at him with mild confusion.
"I'm afraid I don't rightly understand, sir."
He smiled. "It was my way of asking you what you had said to him that you imagined would keep him from coming back."
"I told him I had only pretended to like him all these years. People, particularly gentlemen, don't like to think you have to pretend to like them."
Crane laughed aloud, wondering if the girl had any idea how amusing she was. In the pause that followed, the sound of deep masculine voice could be heard suddenly under their feet. The office was immediately above the servant's sitting room, and it was but too evident that a visitor had just entered. Crane looked at the cook questioningly, and she had the grace to color.
"Oh, did you ever, sir?" she said. "There he is this very moment."
"Shall I go down and forbid him the house?" asked Burton, and though he spoke in fun, he would have been delighted to act in earnest.
"Oh, no, sir, thank you," she answered. "I'm not going back to the kitchen."
This reminded her employer of the extreme difficulty he had experienced in seeing his cook at all. "Why did you try to get out of seeing me, Jane Ellen?" he said. "You knew about what I had to say, I suppose."
"I had a notion, sir."
"And were you afraid?" At this question, the cook bent her head until a shadow fell upon it. But Crane had a clear impression that she was laughing, so clear that he said, And may I ask why it is a comic idea that a servant should be afraid of her employer?" The cook now raised a mask-like face and said most respectfully,
"No, sir, I was not exactly afraid." And having said this, without the slightest warning, she burst into an unmistakable giggle.
Nobody probably enjoys finding that the idea of his inspiring terror is merely ludicrous. Crane regarded his cook with a sternness that was not entirely false. "She's still struggling to regain complete gravity at the corners of her mouth," said civilly.
"Oh, I do hope you'll excuse my laughing, sir. The fact is that it was not I who tried to avoid seeing you. It was Smithfield's idea."
"Smithfield?" cried Crane.
"Yes, sir. He had the notion, I think, that you might be very severe with me, sir, and Smithfield is peculiar. He has a very sensitive nature."
"Well, upon my word," cried Crane, springing to his feet, "that is exactly what Smithfield says about you. It seems to me I have a damn queer houseful of servants."
The cook edged to the door.
"Perhaps it seems so, sir," she said. "Will that be all for tonight?"
"Yes. No," he added hastily. "I have one more thing to say to you, Jane Ellen, and it's this. Don't make the mistake of fancying that I have taken this whole incident lightly. I don't. It really must not happen again. Understand that clearly."
"You mean that if that gentleman came back, you would dismiss me, sir?"
"I think I would," he answered.
"Even if it weren't my fault?"
"Was the fault entirely his, Jane Ellen?"
"Ask him, sir."
"You know much more about it than he does. Was the fault entirely his?"
The cook wriggled her shoulders, crumpled her apron, and seemed unwilling to answer a direct question directly. At last an idea occurred to her. She looked up brightly.
"It was the ice cream, sir," she said. "I was trying to teach him how to freeze ice cream slowly. It ought to be done like this."
And bending over an imaginary freezer, she imitated with her absurdly small hand the suave, gentle rotary motion essential to the great American luxury. As he stood looking down on her, it seemed to Crane extraordinarily clear how it had all happened, so clear indeed that for a second it almost seemed as if he himself were in the place of the culprit whose conduct he had just been condemning. He stepped back hastily.
"No, Jane Ellen," he said, "it was not all his fault. Of that you have convinced me."
She stretched out her hand to the door.
"Will that be all, sir? The cook, you know, has to get up so very early in the morning."
He tried to counteract the feeling of pity and shame that swept over him at the realization that this young and delicate creature had to get up at dawn to work for him and his guests. The effort made his tone rather severe as he said,
"Yes, that's all. Good night."
"Good night, sir,"
she answered with her unruffled sweetness, and was gone. He stood still a moment, conscious of an unusual alertness, both of mind and emotion. At that very alertness made him aware that at that moment, there was a man in his kitchen against whom he felt the keenest personal animosity. Crane would have dearly liked to go down and turn him out, but he resisted the impulse, which somehow savored of Tucker in his mind. And what, by the way, had Tucker been doing in the kitchen? And Smithfield? Why had Smithfield tried to interfere with his seeing the cook? He found plenty of food for reflection. Among other things, he had to consider his return to the drawing-room. Looking at his watch, he observed that a longer time had elapsed since he had left it than he had supposed. There would be comments, there would be attempted jokes from Tucker. Well, that would be easily met by a question as to Tucker's own interest in the culinary art. Mrs. Falconer's methods of attack were not subtle, either. But Cora... He wished Cora would
not just look at him as if he had done something cruel. But as is so often the way, when we prepare ourselves for one situation, quite another one turns up. The three were not sitting awaiting his return. The drawing room was empty, except for Mrs. Falconer, who was reading when he entered, and instead of betraying a conviction that he had been too long away, she looked up and said chattily,
"Well, did you reduce the young woman to order?"
"That is a good deal to expect from an unaided male, isn't it?" said Burton, very much relieved.
"Ah, it depends upon the male, my dear Burton. You, I imagine, could be very terrifying if you wished to be. What did the young woman do? Weep, protest, declare that it had all taken place quite without her consent?"
Burton smiled. He had no intention whatsoever of sharing his recent experiences with Mrs. Falconer.
"Ah," he said, "I see you know your own sex thoroughly. Where are Tuck and your daughter?"
"Solon is taking a turn on the piazza. He hopes it will make him sleep better. And Cora was tired and is gone to bed."
Mrs. Falconer sighed. "Cora doesn't seem very well to me."
"I'm sorry to hear that," returned Crane. "I thought she was looking very fit this evening." He spoke more lightly than he felt. However, for something portentous in Mrs. Falconer's tone struck him with alarm.
"Sit down, Burton," said she, sweeping her hand toward a cushioned stool at her side. "I want to say something to you."
Crane found himself obeying with his hands between his knees and his toes turned in, like a schoolboy who has forgotten his lesson. Then, becoming aware of this pose, he suddenly changed it, crossed one leg over the other, as he had done in the office a few minutes before. In the meantime, Mrs. Falconer was saying,
"The truth is, I'm afraid that we must cut our visit short, delightful as it promises to be."
"Oh, Mrs. Falconer, we're not making you comfortable. What is it?"
"No, Burton, no."
Mrs. Falconer held up her hand. "You are making us perfectly comfortable, at least in all essentials, and who minds roughing it now and then for a week or so? It's good for us," she added playfully.
"The housemaid is not... but no matter."
"What has the housemaid done?" asked Crane with what semblance of interest he could summon. But as he spoke, his heart went out in sympathy to every hotel and boarding house keeper in the world. "Good heavens," he thought, "suppose my living depended on my pleasing them. What a state I should be in." Aloud he said,
"What has Lily been doing?"
"Nothing, nothing. Lily means well, I'm sure, in spite of her lackadaisical ways."
"It is quite a privilege, I assure you, to be waited on by such an elegant young lady. She hooked me up wrong twice this evening, and when I not unnaturally objected, she stuck a pin in me. Oh, by accident, I'm sure. No, I have no fault to find with Lily whatsoever."
"Oh, glad to hear that," said Crane, punctuating his sentence to allow himself to indulge in a half-suppressed yawn.
"Who is it, then? Not Smithfield or the boy?"
"Oh, I should never have anything to do with that boy," said Mrs. Falconer, bridling. "Oh, never in the world. I think he's half-witted. I saw him stick out his tongue at Solon this evening."
Crane laughed, though he knew he ought not to.
"Did Solon see?"
"No, the boy contrived it, so that Solon had just looked away."
"Well, then, perhaps he's not half-witted after all," said Burton. "It occurs to me that perhaps that is the only reply to a good deal that Solon says."
"I'm devoted to Solon," replied Mrs. Falconer, drawing herself up.
"And I must say, you ought to."
I am. "'Said Crane hastily, but I am at the same time able to understand why Brindlebury possibly isn't. "'But come, Mrs. Falconer, if it isn't these servants that are driving you away, what is it?"
"I don't know how to explain it,"
said Mrs. Falconer. "It's not really clear to me myself. I'm sure I don't want to be unkind or to hurt anyone's feelings, at least of all yours, my dear Bert."
And she leaned over and laid her hand on his. Crane gave it a good brisk squeeze and returned it to her lap as if it were too dear for his possessing. And she went on, "I own I am anxious about Cora. She is very deep, very reserved. She tells me nothing. But she is not happy, Burton."
"I'm sorry for that," said Crane in a very matter-of-fact tone. He got up and went to a table where the cigarettes were. The profound male instinct of self-preservation was now thoroughly awake, and he knew exactly what he was in for. Only he noted that if he had had this interview with Mrs. Falconer before he had seen the cook, he might quite easily have been persuaded that in the absence of any more definite vocation, he had been created to make Cora Falconer's life tolerable to her. As it was, he saw perfectly that altruism was no sound basis for matrimony.
"You don't understand what it is to be a mother, Bert."
Crane admitted with a shake of his head that he didn't.
"But I have an instinct that this is not the best place for Cora."
"Well, if you were a man, Mrs. Falconer," said Crane, "I should say that that instinct was the result of being poorly validated. It must be a bore for women to have a wretched maid like Lily. Don't you think that if I found someone a little more competent, that you and Cora would feel that you could put in at least a week or so with us? The hunting is really going to be good, and Cora does enjoy hunting."
Mrs. Falconer refused to lighten the tone of the conversation. She shook her head.
"No," she said, "no. I'm afraid even a good maid would not help. In fact, to speak plainly, my dear Burton."
But at this moment the door opened and Tucker came in. His hair was somewhat rumpled by the wind. His hands were still in his pockets, as he had had them during his constitutional on the front porch, and his eyes, contrasted by the sudden light, looked almost white.
"Well," he said, "are you enjoying this musical party downstairs?"
All three listened in silence and could hear the strains of Home Sweet Home coming from below.
"They have a phonograph and they are singing in parts," said Tucker, as if this somehow made it worse.
"Well, if we got Miss Falconer down, we might do something ourselves," said Crane, but there was nothing frivolous in his manner when he rang and told Smithfield there was too much noise downstairs.
Smithfield begged pardon, and had not a notion it could be heard upstairs. Crane said the boys, Brindlebury's tenor, carried some distance, and Mrs. Falconer and Tucker having gone, he added that the house could be shut for the night. Then he went to the table, and his eye fell again upon the miniature in the pearl frame. He took it up. There was no doubt about it. There was an extraordinary likeness to Jane Ellen. He smiled to himself. How very charming she would look, he thought, in a mauve ball dress. Raising his eyes, he found Smithfield looking at him with an expression he did not thoroughly like.
Join me next time for another romantic chapter of Come Out of the Kitchen by Alice Duer Miller, here on Love's Tender Flame. Until then, love deeply and live beautifully.